Hello guys, this is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio. We've got a special guest that just joined the business course and is into agriculture from a business point of view. And we're going to start, he asked if he could talk to y'all about what's going on with the local farmers. And I know this is kind of odd, but I have a feeling most of y'all do eat. So this isn't too out of whack. And they're just trying to outreach and let some people know so people start reading some labels and you kind of understand what you're getting. And then when we're done with this, it won't be the whole show, then we'll kick it off into some trapping. We've got a great question about keeping raccoons out of coyote sets, just a different version of a question, and we'll get into all that. So why don't you go and introduce yourself. Who are you and where are you from, brother?
My name is Brad Harper and I'm from Michigan.
And you actually do have a small farm, if I understand correct?
Yeah, I got a smaller scale blueberry farm. We got 55 acres, and I do some blackberries and raspberries as well.
Okay, and are you selling those to stores, or to, is it like a U-Pick thing?
We do a lot to the what I call backdoor markets, as far as all the local fruit stands. And there's a lot of different, like, smaller farm markets where, you know, they're baking pies and doing donuts, and we try to do as much of that as we possibly can. But a lot of the bigger farms, you know, where you're talking more than just a few acres, then we start selling to the Walmarts and the Meijer and all the big grocery stores like that in the big market.
Okay, so you sent me an email this morning, and I was kind of confused of exactly what it was. So why don't you just explain kind of what's going on with local farmers and the best way that people can deal with this?
Yeah, I wanted to reach out because what we're running into now is Mexico, Chile, Peru, even Canada, is they're all shipping produce to America while our season is. So like for blueberries, you know, my season's July to September, and now we got Peru and Chile shipping blueberries in during that time. Same thing with asparagus, apples, cherries, you know, basically all produce is dealing with this now. And there's a big campaign, and we got lobbyists going and just trying to educate our customers as far as just reading the labels. And when you're at the grocery store, you know, trying to decide which one you want, just take a look at your labels, see where it's coming from. We got a lot of chemicals that have been banned here for very good reasons for a while, and they're basically still using them over there. They don't have the same food safety audits that we do. Obviously, their labor laws are completely different. We have fairly high minimum wage here, and they're just working for dollars compared to pennies over there. And we just wanted to kind of reach out, touch as many people as we can, and just let them know, hey, you know, it takes 2 seconds to read a label, and by choosing American, obviously you're helping the farmer down the line, and you're helping that packing house where he got his packed, and helping their neighbors. And we're just trying to kind of push that movement, because it's not really going very good at the government level trying to get stuff like that passed. So
You would think, though, that I mean, as much as Trump has talked about farming, that he would be an ally on this.
And that's what we're really, that's why we're trying to do a lot right now, because I think he's going to be our best friend, especially compared to other possible candidates down the road. I think he's really the one that's going to be pushing something like this, and he already helped a lot of the dairy farmers out with dairy stuff coming from Canada, which was a big plus. We just weren't able to get all the other produce on that we wanted to, and that's something that it's still in the works, and we got representatives and, like I said, lobbyists that are all kind of working together to get something pushed through. And you know how long that stuff takes when it's dealing with politicians. So we're just trying to kind of start at the end consumer, where we can really actually make the biggest difference, because even the Walmarts and all your big grocery stores, you know, of course they're going to try to bring that in because that's cheaper. So if we can make a statement with the consumer saying, hey, we want American, I don't want this crap from Chile, you know, where's something from Florida or Idaho or wherever, if we can make that statement from the consumer end, then that's really going to go a long ways as far as working up, you know, kind of from both sides.
Well, I'm surprised as a farmer you don't support the communist and the socialist people running for president. That's always worked out for you guys.
No.
Well, you said a few things that I just want to elaborate on so people kind of understand. I'm assuming it's just kind of been a gentleman's rule that if our produce is in season, the other countries stay out, and then when they're in their season and we're out of our season, because like most people don't realize, blueberries don't grow year round. You know, I mean, I grow them, so I know that. So when, you know, and if everybody, just from a business point of view, from the world, dumps on the market at the same time, that means there's such a supply that they turn into nothing as far as value goes. Is that what Correct. The issue is?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it was more of a gentleman thing. It was, you know, it's been slowly getting worse and worse. And what happens is they're coming up with new varieties that are, you know, either earlier or later. And in these other climates where, you know, you don't have the 2 or 3 month season like we have in Michigan, where they might have a couple different seasons because they got such a long growing season to where they can have a few different varieties, and now they're attacking the market for a lot longer stretch. So it's a lot more of just, they're basically trying to just grow whatever they possibly can in their season and get it shipped here because obviously they're making the most money there. And that's kind of one thing that most people don't mind having, you know, fruits and vegetables throughout the winter. Like, that's not the big deal. The issue is that they're coming in during our season, and that really starts screwing things up.
Yeah, but I mean, because, you know, I've played around with hydroponics and greenhouses. If you're going to try to do produce that way, it's so much more expensive, and people would definitely balk. So, you know, I don't particularly like the other country, like you said, and I don't think people understand how bad some of these chemicals are that these other countries are using. I mean, what we use is pretty bad. What they use is terrible. I mean,
yeah, and
as far as health-wise.
Exactly. I mean, if it's been banned here for a while, you know that that's obviously something that ain't too good.
Yeah. Yeah,
And that all goes back to a lot of these audits as well. I mean, really, the farmer, he don't want to spray, and the consumer, they don't want fruit that's sprayed. It's more of the bureaucrats in the middle that are kind of drawing these rules up that the farmers have to abide by. So it's almost kind of the farmer and the end user want the same thing. We just have to follow these rules, and that's a lot that, you know, the consumers normally don't hear about. That they're not hearing what everything that we have to go through in order to sell our fruit to a Walmart or something like that. And that's just, like I said, we're trying to educate people as far as everything that takes place on our end. And we want to be as much have as much transparency as possible and just kind of work together.
You know, I've seen videos of tilapia and shrimp in China growing in the sewer ponds with tampons and turds floating by, and they're picking those fish up and sending them over here. I mean, it is, you can't pay me to eat tilapia. I mean, there's just no way after seeing, I mean, they're picking them up, and it is unbelievable. It comes over here and you know, the market says it's healthy. And then one of the things that I've noticed, I've been seeing more of, is I personally make the decision, you know, and everybody gets to make their own decision. I try not to eat fruit that's got a lot of chemicals on it. You know, I can't help it all the time, but I try to. And when I see these organic coming from these third world countries, who in the world is checking that? Do you know?
That's a great question. And that, I don't know exactly who checks up on that. A nice little something that I can tell you. So, like, I'm a conventional blueberry farmer. It's definitely pushing back that everyone's slowly starting to go the organic route. You know, that's big, and everyone is all for that, which is great. I mean, that's awesome. But as far as, like, when my fruit hits a lot of the docks, what happens is they'll actually run a test for pesticide residue, and we have to be under, which, don't quote me, I don't remember the exact number, but it's like 13 or 20 parts per million. So, I mean, if we're above that, that whole load gets kicked back, and that they don't sell that. So that is good that which that's American fruit. I can't tell you that when it comes from them other places that they're doing the same thing, because I don't know how you would regulate that or anything, especially when it sits on a boat for 2 weeks. But that is something good that you can feel good about when you do buy American produce. You know that that's being checked and monitored.
Because, you know, I know, I mean, I've rant and railed mostly on just the craziness of really big farms, you know, that grow soybean and corn, and corporations that own farms and farms and farms of that. It just doesn't make sense to me. But produce farmers are a lot different than the big mechanized guys. I mean, you know, that's basically someone's got to grow. How many acres of blueberries did you say you have?
We got 55.
You know, that is a ton of work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's something that I'm just swamped. I can't keep up from day one when we start. I'm, you know, 2 weeks behind already as far as the work goes. But that's also something like specialty fruits, the specialty vegetables and all that kind of produce. Those kind of farmers, you know, that, like you say, it's a lot different from some giant corn and bean guy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're feeding all the local farm markets and these farm stands, and you know, that's when you really start supporting your community, and it actually makes you feel good. You know, that's kind of cool to be a part of that. And that's just on a whole nother level of farming, I guess you'd say.
Well, I hate to say it, but since I've been eating carnivore, I hadn't been supporting that many farmers.
Hey, that's okay. Because I know you're supporting American grown beef there.
Oh, yeah. By the cow. But is there anything else that you want to say? I mean, it's basically, if it's dirty, I guess, one, someone would have to know what season is for stuff. You know, like oranges are in the winter, blueberries are, you know, at a certain time, because I'm sure yours are different than ours. But, you know, we always say American made, but I'm always amazed that people don't really back that up with their wallet.
No, and that's a couple things that the USA Farmers Union is doing, is they are putting together an actual produce calendar, and it's going to be something more of like an app to where all of a sudden potatoes hit in Idaho or Wisconsin, boom, that'll pop up on that app, and then you know, you'll be able to share that social media wise or however that works. But that's in the works, which is a really awesome tool. But really the main thing is you just read the labels, and they're getting tricky with it because they know kind of what we're trying to do here, and it'll the whole label will say California and this and that, and then you gotta really look for it, and on the back in small print it says product of Peru. And it's like, oh, okay. And then, you know, 2 feet over they might have a little section that actually is California or Florida or something. And it's just, that's basically what we're trying to push, is read the labels, know where your stuff's coming from, and you can actually feel good about, you know, supporting American produce.
Right.
Especially because it really don't, it most of the time the produce, it doesn't cost anymore to the end user. It's more of, you know, the wholesale costs are obviously a lot different, but the end user most of the time in produce is not that much different. So it's not like you're having to spend a lot more money in groceries or anything like that.
So basically you're saying the middleman in the store is where the profit's going. It's probably correct. Not even going to the farmer in Peru.
No, and I mean, it's hard to say, but like even American produce, which I don't remember the numbers on that either. I don't have anything in front of me, but it's like pennies on the dollar of American produce actually get back to the farmer. You know, you got all these shipping costs, you got the middlemen, the packaging, the processing, and all that stuff of it actually getting packed and getting to the store, that it that's kind of the same thing too, but it's obviously a lot more when it's coming from Peru at a much lower cost.
It's amazing it can be that cheap and they got to ship it that far.
No, I know, and that's what, it just, that boggles my mind, that it can literally throw a load on a plane or a boat, and they can still get it here for that cost. That's just incredible how they can do that.
So the only negative from anything you said is the group you're talking about's got the word union in it. Can y'all change that?
That's, That's definitely not my idea, but yeah, that's just what it is. And that's what's funny too, how that stuff works when you start dealing with the politicians and whatnot. You got to have different names and different setups. You know, let's just say that you made an organization. Well, depending on how you make that and the name of it, well, you might only be able to lobby with that. You know, you need a whole separate one if you want it to be more of a co-op, to where farmers get together to push something like this. And that's what, I don't know how any of that works, and I don't really want to know, to be honest with you. And that's just kind of how it works.
So if I get to go see Trump, I need to start a predator control group union?
That, there we go. And we'll lift the ban on trap sizes, and we'll push American produce.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you doing this. I think it's just something people need to know. I mean, it's, to me, people are so oblivious as a general rule about where their food does come from. You know, I mean, I understand that I'm extreme because I kill most of it and I process it and I freeze it and I eat it. But it's, I'm just amazed when I talk to certain people, like family members, they have no idea, you know, that probably the apples that you're getting at a different time of year is either really old, or that's why they're mealy. They just don't understand. They're just, you know, they're just so far removed from their food.
No, exactly. And that's something, like I said, that farmers want to have that transparency to really show start to finish, and obviously try to get better at that. But I mean, like you say, most people don't know, and that's something that we want to educate, you know, kind of get people thinking about. I know a lot of people grow their own food, which is great because you're still shutting down that foreign market, which that's fine. But, you know, same thing. I mean, shoot, all we eat is venison and beef from the neighbors, and I know where all that comes from, you know, and it's like you go to the store, it's hard telling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you get into this business course, you're going to be thinking about this in such a different way, dude. I mean, like one of the things with local farmers I wish they would do is, like, you know, those little, I don't even know what you call them, but you put your phone on them and you take a picture of it and it sends a link and opens the link on your phone. You know, it looks like a, like a ink dot at a psychiatrist.
Yep.
If you could put that on the individual, if every, because it's just a sticker, just a small sticker on every tomato and cucumber and stuff like that, and someone at the grocery store can hit that link, know the farmer, know where it's from, know, you know, when it was picked, and you could see a video of the farm, and you could make a really good decision based on that. And it wouldn't cost very much money because most farms have a website anyway.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's funny you say that because that is actually being applied right now, and it's getting in the works. You know, I can imagine that kind of on a whole American scale, that is kind of hard to make that all happen kind of through one entity, but that is in the works, and when it will be done, I don't know, but very soon you will be able to scan that produce, you know, the, if you go buy a bag of potatoes or a can of corn or something, you're going to be able to scan that, see where exactly it came from, and it's literally going to pull up a profile of that farmer. So you'll be able to see, you know, basically what his audit scores are, or how he's done as far as pesticide programs. You know, you'll be able to see all of that, and that's, they're definitely working towards that, and I think that's great. You know, that's a good way to keep everybody honest and open, and obviously then you know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. Well, any last words you can think of before we get on to some catching some fur?
No, other than up here we're pretty soggy. I should be setting muskrat traps in the middle of my blueberries, but other than that, no, I just want to thank you for everything and Trapping Radio, and I really appreciate you letting me do this.
Oh, you're more than welcome, brother.
All right, well, thanks. Take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Sacred site.
All right,
if
guys.
You're in sacred site.
Good grief. I'm in the truck, if you can't tell. I got electronics everywhere. So, welcome to Trapping Radio. the original, even though it's probably right now you're thinking it's the original produce podcast. It's the original trapping podcast. I believe this is 378, and whenever I try to guess that, I get it wrong because I'm not in front of my computer. But we've been doing this for a long time, and I would like to think that we're probably the most flexible trapping podcast out there. Most of the time, pretty entertaining, but definitely the most furriest. So, welcome, and we're going to talk about some different things today. One of them is a question from a listener that I've talked about this subject in the past, but not in the same way that he's asking, which makes this question very interesting to me. And I'm going to play that. But before I do, I want to thank our sponsors that actually, you know, make sure that we have some money to pay for the servers, and you know, where I have a little bit of accountability for this, just for the simple fact that I don't get lazy, you know. So I mean, that's just the truth, because we're like crazy busy right now. But we do have what I believe is the best sponsors in the trapping industry, and the reason I say that are these are guys that I personally do business with all the time. And I've known all of them. I've seen them at shows. I've been out to dinner with them, and I've all the business we've done, and the honesty and the caring of customers and all that means a lot to me, and it means just as much to them. So that's why we have them. First one we're going to talk about is Dunlap Lures. Jeff Dunlap, he's a good friend of mine. Y'all probably know him from Hellfire and Soul Taker, and watching your girlfriend run out of a convention when someone opens a bottle of the Hellfire. You know, he is a tremendous lure maker. And we're going to be working on putting on a school together next, I believe it's September. And we're gearing up to do some stuff for YouTube, which I think you'll enjoy, under the Trapping Mafia acronym, because we've been kind of called that from some of the organizations, so I just figured that was applicable. And then we have F&T, everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. And you can call them up and get a catalog. I don't have a catalog. I just don't do the paper catalog. It's not for a hippie reason. It's just my stuff's in so many different catalogs. It doesn't make sense for the expense. But if you're looking for a catalog with all my stuff in there, you can get F&T's. Tremendous business that they do, and they're so proficient at it. Then we have Oki Cable and Trap out of Oklahoma. Jeb's has got a full supply line. I don't know if he's buying fur this year. He has year after year. It'd be hard for him not to, I'm sure. And when he does that, he's got a lot of bobcat meat and stuff like that that you can pick up if you want to play around with your own baits. We have Wildlife Control Supplies. They're out of Connecticut. And if you do anything in the ADC world, they have you covered. And they also have you covered in regular fur trapping. A very professional company. And then Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, which, you know, Trap Tags is in their name. The company's been around for a long time. Alan purchased that. And they still do the same quality trap tags. They have all the traps. They are on eBay and Amazon and Bonanza and Walmart, and they have all my deer stuff, and they have these tremendous into the predator calling as far as the calls. If you're into that, you definitely want to give him a shot. Just great people to work with, and the shipping that they do is very, very fast. So that's our sponsors, and I now want to get to this question. See what happens. Okay, we're getting close.
Hey, Clint. Well, I hope all is well with you. Got a question that doesn't seem to get a whole lot of attention to, and that's cutting raccoons and possums off and skunks to your canine sets. My question is, this time of the year, you know, I like the Primal Pace bait and the Federales and my dog proofs, because they seem to, they'll skip over that sweet stuff and go straight to it. But my question is, do you think it will screw with the canines, or maybe wise and make them more wise and more shy to sits if you're using, like, say, Federalis or Primal Paste Bait or whatever in your dog proofs, cutting off raccoons to your canine sets? Oh, I didn't know if them, Kyle would stick his tongue down off in the dog proof, try to lick that up out of there and, snap it off. I don't know. I've never had that happen. I'm sure anything's possible. But I guess it's more of a, they're going to smell that Federalis in that dog proof, and then they're going to end up seeing raccoons caught in those dog proofs and stuff. So I was kind of curious if they'll associate that smell with danger more because they see the raccoons caught off in the dog proofs using that bait. Which normally I'll mix it up if I go on a farm and do a control job or ADC job, whatever you really want to call it. I'll run through there with dog proofs with, say, Primal Paste Bait, but then my flat sets, dirt hole sets, whatever I make for canines and bobcat, I'll use, say, Federalis. But I was just kind of curious, I've never seen that question really asked a whole lot, or never see it touched on as far as using same baits for raccoons and dog proofs, cutting them off to your canine sets. So, I hope to hear back from you soon, and hope y'all keep wearing them out. Thank you.
That is, to me, a very well thought out question, because we've talked in the past, and I've showed in demos, that when you get in an area that's got a lot of raccoons or possums or whatever, and mostly for me, just because of what I've done more of in the past, I've worried more about raccoons on bobcat sets because the time invested into putting my system in is a little bit longer than putting in a dirt hole or a coyote flat set. So I try to protect those, and what I will do is I'll go, if it's on a road, I'll get 10-15 feet away and I'll put dog proofs in. With the cats, the raccoon struggling and the way that their brain works, it does not seem to affect anything. I've never really thought about it with coyotes before. I have been in some places where, like Louisiana, there's probably other places like this. It may be, absolutely infested with skunks or something. But Louisiana has got about 3 possums per square foot, especially if it warms up and it drizzles. It is phenomenal to see. You will take a possum out of a set, look around, there'll be 3 possums you're visibly seeing that aren't in a trap. That's not an exaggeration sometimes. So in those particular situations, what I would do is I would put in a bunch of really crude dirt hole sets with like 1.5s if I had them, 8 or 10 sets really, really quick over a couple of days, and try to hammer that local population of possums. And then I would go back to doing what I was doing and praying it didn't warm up and drizzle again. And I would still catch possums in my regular sets, but it would not be on the basis of what it is. And there was an old timer in Louisiana that I kind of got that from, because what he said when he went into areas to coyote trap, he would go in with 5 or 6 cages for 3 or 4 days and try to catch all the possums and coons and stuff like that out of the way first, because he knew how many of those animals they are. Like here in Tennessee, that's not really necessary. We have possums, we have skunks, and we have raccoons. But where I live in the eastern part, the more mountainous part, it's not a huge number of any of them. Like I may go run a bunch of coyote traps and catch a possum or 2, or on a bad day, 3. That's livable. if I'm close to the river or something, my raccoon numbers may go up a little bit. We just don't have a lot of raccoons. Not like Iowa and the Midwest and some of the places in the Northeast and along the coast. Like, you get around the coast of North Carolina, there's 1,000 of these little bitty skinny coon running around. So here, it's not that big of a deal. For coyotes, though, I think that's something to ponder on, and I'm going to be completely honest. I don't have the correct answer, but I'm going to give a theory. If you're going to be using a predator bait in your dog-proof traps, like this time of year when I go out with my FB1s and FB2s and I'm trying to catch raccoons on control jobs or whatever it is, after about mid-December, I switch over to predator baits, and I don't really worry about the very sweet stuff like I use early season. Once the season comes on, they've already built up their fat, they've ate a lot of carbohydrates, and then when it starts getting cold, they're going to want some carbohydrates, but what they start seem to crave is protein. They'll start eating a lot of beaver carcasses and all kind of stuff that they kind of shy away from earlier. So you can tell that their body is at that point. It's like they gorged themselves in the fall and with corn and you know, berries and cherries and everything else they can get to put as much fat on them so they can stay as fat as long as possible in the winter. And once they got this big insulation coat on, their body's telling them you need protein, and they go after protein. So what the gentleman is saying, at this time of year, which it's January, he's using predator baits, and he's using Primal Paste and Federales. But what he's concerned with, and I can see this, is that going to screw up his coyote trapping? I would have to say, just from a armchair theory point of view, that if I was going to use, say, Federales in my dog proofs, because that's what the coon are hitting, I probably wouldn't use Federales in the dirt hole or on the flat sets. I do not want to give that coyote anything to associate from seeing a struggling animal to where I'm trying to catch him. Most of the time, I'm trying to catch raccoons or I'm trying to catch coyotes. And like I said, I'm not in really areas except for when I get down in the deep south that it's been an issue. And most of the time, I'm trying to protect the cat sets. So if you were to use Federales in your, just an example, we'll call that bait A, in your dog proofs because you're having good luck with it, which it works very well, then I might actually switch, and this goes against business practice, but I'm just going to be honest with you. I would probably switch the lure maker to another lure maker to make sure, and I would smell the baits to make sure they're not very similar, to get a totally different type of attraction. So if I was using the bait A of Federales and I was going to go out and set coyote traps, see, the primal is completely different from the Federales, but the trapper may not know that. And you call up a lure maker, and he's going to try to figure out why you're asking this question. And depending on the honesty of the lure maker, he may or may not tell you the truth. The Primal Paste bait, except for two ingredients, is very similar to the gator bait. So I definitely wouldn't want to be mixing those two that close. Now, the Primal and the Federales, they're completely different. I don't think you would have any issues. But I wouldn't want to put the Federales in the dog proof, then put it in the dirt hole or the flat set, just because I don't want to have any association that a coyote can pick up on. I think the smarter thing to do is, if you're going to use my Federales to do what this gentleman is talking about doing, I would go to a totally different lure maker and buy the predator bait. Or go to use something natural or something where you know that it's not similar. Because a lot of baits from a particular lure maker, there's things that I have learned trigger certain things over and over again. And I have a tendency to mix that up in different ways because I know it works. Well, another lure maker, like say Jeff, he learned from his dad, and he's, you know, built lures since then because he has that base knowledge. Like his Soul Taker is nothing like Federale's Primal or Gator Bait. I've smelled it. It's completely opposite. Or you could get Hiawatha Valley, or you could get Powder River Pace Bait from O'Gorman, or any other of the lures, you know, Fur Taker from Blackie, which is now Scott Welch. You could switch those up, but I think you're going to be safer to use a bait from one lure maker in the Dog Proofs and another bait from another lure maker at the Coyote Sets, if that kind of makes sense. It's coyotes can get very phobic, and they pick up on patterns, I believe, very quickly. I don't think they're smart, you know, like they're not going to be doing calculus. Sorry about that, but I'm in the truck and there's no way to turn the volume down on the people calling. They pick up on patterns, and if one is a pattern of danger, they have a tendency just to stay away. You know, like coyotes just have a tendency, if something is off, they don't screw with the set, they just go on down the trail. They're not like a fox. They're not going to sit there and screw with it. So that's what you need to understand about these type things. So that would be my recommendation. It would just be completely different. And I can promise you that this gentleman is right. Later in the year, you're better off with more protein-based than sweet-based. At least if you're having any type of winter. Like right now, we got some type of weird weather system going on. It is 60 degrees in January. Even for Tennessee, this isn't normal. And our normal, we've had, you know, frost last couple mornings, and it's getting up in the 50s. I wouldn't be afraid at that point to go back to some sweet and see if they start hitting it. But it's, you know, it's kind of like you. If you were really hungry in the winter, food's hard to get, you come across a big T-bone steak or you come across a candy bar, you're probably going to crave that steak just a little bit more, because it's not so much just the taste, it's you need that nutrition. And I think that's what raccoons get. So that's what I would do. That's a great question, man. And if you've got questions that are, you know, thought-provoking, and, you know, they're... Be very specific when you do that. All you have to do is get on your phone and hit the record, which most modern phones have. You talk into it, save the file, send me the file in an email, and then all I have to do is play it, and then everybody can hear it. And it, because it's a lot better, I think, that way, because you can kind of hear from the person their inflection of the words and different things like that, and I think it makes it more interesting. So if you have questions, don't be afraid to ask me. Now I want to go into something that I've had a couple of conversations. I get calls constantly this time of year, and it seems to me, from talking to a lot of different trappers, that hardcore is always good and not hardcore is somewhat less. Now, I want everybody to think about this in a logical fashion with me, because I don't want people to get frustrated are thinking they have to be a certain way when they're not. Everybody out there has got different personalities. Randy Smith is hardcore when it comes to trapping to the bone. He's hardcore when he goes raccoon hunting. He's hardcore when it comes to raising his dogs that he sells to other raccoon hunters. He's hardcore in his animal damage control business and his pesticide business. He's hardcore when he takes his son squirrel hunting. Randy's personality is 1,000 miles an hour in hardcore. That's easy for Randy because that's really Randy. See, it's easier for me to be hardcore trapping when I'm doing it all day long. Like when you see some of the videos from Texas or Mississippi or Arkansas or whatever, that's daylight till dark. I'm not doing anything else. I'm not making lure. I'm not going to a job. I'm not dealing with all the realities of life. It's 100% focused trapping, and my personality fits that. It's easier for me, but it's not more than somebody else. Because I tell you what I think is actually harder for people. See, it's easy to be what you are if you're honest with yourself. It's easy to be over the edge. It's easy to be run like your hair's on fire. It's easier to try to get that extra 10 traps out. It's easier to set, the 50 more snares. It's easier to do that if your personality is kind of almost that's just what your personality is. I'm trying to think of an adjective for that without saying maybe addicted. That's not really a good abbreviation for that. But I tell you what's harder is someone that has to balance a job and at the same time balance kids and a family and all the realities of life while they go trapping. That's actually much harder than me or Randy or a lot of other guys to set our butt on fire and just head off. It's much harder to have balance in what you're doing. See, what me and Randy does is not very balanced. If I get into fishing, there's nothing balanced about it. If I decide I want to fill the freezer full of deer, there's nothing balanced about the way that I go about that. When I started trying to get in shape and lift weights, it's not the most balanced way to go about it. It's wide open. I'm worried about the diet. I'm worried about how much weight I'm lifting. I'm worried about the volume. I'm worried about how many days I'm in the gym. I'm worried about the recovery, and I'm pushing the limits all the time because that's my personality. But I also don't have kids, and my wife is healthy, and we've got our finances finally after a couple of decades of doing this business where it's not so stressful on that anymore. So it's easy for me to go do that or other people to go do that, but it's harder. And I think guys should take pride in doing trapping because, let's just be honest. Trapping is something we do. That is not exactly who we are if you're going to have a balanced life. There's other things in life. You got girls and kids and jobs and bills and, other things you want to do. Like I've got friends that go crazy for turkeys and all that stuff. That's one thing we do. And it's easier to have a balance that way. I'm in this industry every single day. So it's very different. And what I don't want people to get caught up in is that the only way that you're really good and hard charging and stuff like that is if you emulate somebody that takes everything to the edge. Because you just may not be in that particular place in your life where you can do that. And to balance running 50 traps with a whole bunch of other crap going on is a lot harder sometimes than going out and being full time where you don't have to think about anything else. Because when we're in that mode, we'll get to that later. That's just the way that it is. But a lot of guys don't have that. So don't get thinking that hardcore is the only way. I see this in weightlifting all the time. It's easy to say you're going to eat everything you see to get 6,000 calories a day. You're going to work out in the gym every day. And you're going to push yourself to failure on every set, if that's your personality. You're not really sacrificing anything to do that. But the guy that's got all this stuff going on, that's hopping in the gym, you know, 3-4 times a week, busting his butt for an hour and a half and going home and trying to somewhat keep a good diet and be healthy, that dude has got to balance a lot for that to work out. And in the long run, you're probably better off being balanced. Because I can tell you from a marriage point of view, when you get so focused on something, you can screw some stuff up. And you don't want to do that. So that's just something I've been thinking about, because it's I'm getting, you know, the more social media seems to get into trapping, it's kind of like if you're not catching the most, or you're not catching running the most traps, or you don't have the latest and greatest traps, then it's just like, it doesn't matter. But that's not true. Running 50 traps before and after work is a lot harder than me running 150 traps in 12 hours. You should be proud of that. You should be excited about the idea that you've got enough balance in your life that you still can go out and enjoy trapping. Put up the fur, all the other stuff that goes along with it, and just enjoy what you're doing. I think that's something that you need to focus on. And if you do that, you won't let all these other outside pressures come in, because it's just not your life like it is some of us. You may want it to be one day, but if it's not, don't let it get you down. Do what you can do with what you got today. And you'll probably enjoy this a whole lot better. All right, I want to finish up with something that I have been so over the top on the coyote phobia that after talking with a gentleman the other day, I want to clarify something. When I talk about coyotes being phobic, guys, they definitely are. But that has a lot to do with what you, the trapper, does, or me, the trapper, does, for that matter. So when we're looking at flat sets, let's just keep it's keep that kind of what it is. Basically, you've got three sets until I come up with Carpet Bomb next year. You've got dirt holes, flat sets, and blind sets. And you can have a mixture of some of those, believe it or not, but that's basically a dirt hole is a hole. Be a hole in a tree, basically. It can be a hole in the ground. You have flat sets where it's smeared on something. Your lure is, or your attractant is, it's smeared under something, it's smeared on the face of something, and all that. And a lot of coyote trappers, me included, believe that it's better to run more flat sets than it is dirt hole sets, because there's a lot of historical reasons for that. The dirt hole is more apt and designed for fox than it is coyote, even though you'll catch some coyotes in them. You'll catch some pups, and you can work the sets. You can understand how an adult coyote comes up and a pup coyote comes up, and you can really get a dirt hole to work for you. I'm not saying you can't. But coyotes have a tendency to work flat sets quicker to come to them, but they also work it faster sometimes, which can be a negative. And sometimes it's hard because a flat set works a lot more off of wind, you know, because you're not dealing with visuals, which we're getting ready to talk about. The visuals on flat sets can be very productive. Just keep in mind what you're trying to do with that visual. So the downside of a flat set sometimes is you get swirling wind, you get wind changes. There's nothing to line that animal up. You may pick something on the side of a field that stands out a little bit, like a clump of grass or a rock or a log or something that's out there. You know, like in Texas, I used to set a lot of the oil pipes would just smear lure inside of them, kind of like flat sets. Something that kind of gets their attention, but you're playing off of the wind. So your lure, when you're doing a flat set a lot of times, you want the wind to hit the back of the set, go across your lure, your trap's in front. The coyote has got to work the wind to get close enough to the attractor for you to catch him. And it's just smell, which is great. Because on the phobic scale of a coyote, that's really low. You know, unless you're using like an ounce of something that's stout or something like that. I mean, if you use reasonable amounts of lure and, you know, it's good lure, a coyote's not going to really show any fear of that, and they got to work the wind they get into. Because there is no visual, there's a couple of things that happen at these sets. The wind can give you problems with foot placement, which we're going to cover a quick way on thinking about that. And the other is, if you've never set a lot of flat sets, there's a good chance you're not going to trust them. So if you don't trust something, you may put some of them out, put them in not as good locations because you know, you have more faith in a dirt hole, and then you don't catch in the flat set, so you go, well, they don't work for me, then you continue doing what you're doing. Because you can't see anything, you think the animal can't find it. I was the exact same way when I started flat sets. I thought it was silly. I thought it was stupid. I thought it was nonsense. Because I didn't understand how powerful a coyote's nose was. There are attractants you can use on flat sets, guys, that can give you confidence. And you can also help line up a coyote. And you can use small feathers. Like if you know someone with chickens, I'm not talking about a big wing feather. I'm talking about, you know, like a couple of feathers off its back, you know, where they're like an inch long. They're just there and they wiggle really good. Instead of doing like you would for a cat, you take a big handful of these feathers and you throw them down on the ground and it looks like something got slaughtered. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about one or two of those feathers. Take a paper clip or take some very fine wire in line with your trap of how you think that coyote's going to work that set, and you put that in the bush. You put that in the grass. You kind of wedge that with, you know, like a piece of wire into the end of a log. Just little. Almost where a coyote's coming down, he smells something, and it's just enough visual attractant to get him to go, what is that? Huh. And you kind of get his curiosity up a little bit, and he goes over. I've talked about T-bones before. I think you're better off with a T-bone just to give them a peek of the bone. Not to set that thing up in there like it fell out of a spaceship and just impaled itself into the ground. Beat it in the ground, cover it up with some duff and some dirt, expose just a little bit of it, like the size of a dime, quarter at the most. They're going to see it because they're going to smell what you've got there. And that is one of those really neat things that you can do to get coyotes. Feathers are easy. Cotton, just, you know, like a quarter of a cotton ball, kind of smush it out. You can take some wire or a small nail or anything like that, push it into the wood. Something to visibly let that coyote see, sort of. It's kind of like what it must have been like back in the Victorian days when women didn't show any skin, and the idea of a man seeing a girl's ankle was like full-on porn. That's kind of what you're going for. You're not going for today's porn. You're going for Victorian porn. You just want to like show a glimpse of the ankle. That must have been a weird time. But very small amounts is what you're trying to get. Nothing big, nothing showy, nothing audacious, nothing that really anybody, unless they're really close, walking through the woods is even going to notice. A little bit of cotton, a little bit of feathers, a little bit of bone. You can take, you know, a lot of people use paws, which are good. I've used thousands of them. You're skinning an animal, you cut off its paws, and you stick it for a flat set. What I've noticed is most people have that thing sticking out there, again, like it fell down from an alien ship. And that's kind of weird when you think about it. But if you were to drive that in the ground a little bit more, up against some grass, barely show the woman's ankle, just, you know, like a couple of the pads and a claw, you will get more reaction from a coyote with a tease than you will a billboard. So don't think you can't use attractants when it comes to flat sets. You just need to use the right attractants when it comes, or the optimal attractants when it comes to flat sets. Because when you will catch other animals at flat sets because of their smell, but when you're actually going after coyotes, keep them small, keep them out of the billboard selection of just a handful of feathers or a great big bone or a huge leg or a deer skull. I mean, all that's fine. Just tease them with it. And, you know, the thing about bigger toys at sets, if you just tease them with it, when they rake back on a deer skull, or which I used a lot of in Texas javelina skulls, the more that as they dig back, they think they found something and they work it a lot harder. If it's just sitting out in there in the open, it's just a skull. If you tease them with it and they think they found something, they start getting excited. The more excited you get a coyote, kind of like the old Victorian porn, I guess if you show an ankle back then, it was big deal, the more reaction you're going to get. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and lock this up. Travis has showed up, and we have got to continue to move stuff from one building to the next. Yay! I can't wait. So, hope y'all guys are having a good trapping season. I hope you go out and you play with some small, teasing flat sets. I hope you look at your labels on your produce, because it actually matters to real people, including you. And you think about different things, just like the gentleman did with that question. Is something you're doing going to mess up your coyote hunting? You know, your trapping. And the more you think, the more you're going to ask questions, the more you're going to find those answers. And lo and behold, before you know it, you're racking them up, which is going to lead to more questions, which is going to lead to more answers, which eventually you're going to be like the man, because everybody else has stayed 20 years ago. That's how you become really good at trapping.